Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and the law firm of Garfield, Kelly & White, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
Hello, this is Neil Garfield from a now sunny Tallahassee, and we are coming out of a deep freeze. Fortunately, the temperatures are warming, and we didn't have the problems of Atlanta. I'm delighted to be back on the air with you, those of you who are followers of the Living Lies blog. This is our substitute for what was the teleconference that we used to do on a free conference, and which only members could listen to and pay $49 a month. You no longer have to do that. This will be on every week for 30 minutes, and we might expand the show to be longer than that. It is a real pleasure to be with you again. And if you have questions, you go to the, if you're by a computer, you can go to the chat room. Those questions that we don't get to during the show will still be addressed either by video or by email. You will get a response at some point to your question. I was preparing the agenda for today and found that in my email, Ken McLeod, who is out in Arizona and is our investigator extraordinaire, brought to my attention an appellate decision in Arizona that highlighted many of the things that we've been talking about for several years on the Living Lies blog and on our conferences and in my articles and appearances on radio and television. The decision, first let me say that congratulations to attorney Barbara J. Ford, F-O-R-D-E, in Scottsdale, showing that if you plead right and you really investigate and do your forensic analysis and all of that and put in the facts, that you'll actually get a result. In this case, it's a common story. The homeowner, Steinberger, is actually the executor of the estate of someone who passed away and was contesting a foreclosure. And there was numerous efforts to get modification and various issues raised by Attorney Ford on behalf of the homeowner. And the decision that came out of the appellate court is a 33-page decision, and contrary to what some people are already saying, it does not run against the Hogan decision, which was made by the Arizona Supreme Court. It was made in accordance with that decision. And the Hogan court, if you remember, and I pointed it out when it came out, was really a blueprint on how to do it right. They kept mentioning that various types of allegations were not made, and therefore they could not consider it. In this case, Attorney Ford did make the right allegations and was specific in the facts that she alleged on behalf of her client. And this decision of Steinberger versus One West involved IndyMac and the FDIC sharing, loss sharing arrangement, etc. And what we know now is that the payments by third parties are considered by this court, and I think will be considered by most courts, to be a discharge of the debt as it was originally framed. In other words, that debt, which is the loan itself, the mortgage, is discharged to the extent the payments received by the creditor. In this case, the issue was the FDIC, IndyMac, One West agreement, in which FDIC agreed to pay off losses to the tune of 80%. And the position taken by Attorney Ford was that this was a discharge of the debt and not subject to the amount required to pay off the debt or otherwise redeem their position. And the court agreed. They said that One West received money from the FDIC to pay off a loss on the loan, and that discharges the debt to the extent of the payments. Now, when you apply that same theory to servicer advances, insurance, and so forth, the same result would obtain, but you that there's a caveat here, and that is that the allegation has to be that the payment was made, not that it could be made or might have been made. It can't be hypothetical. And so it comes down to the issue of it's all about the money and not about just documents. I've said many times on the blog and in my appearances that it's very unlikely to have a judge that is going to say that you don't have to pay anything because an I wasn't dotted, a T wasn't crossed, or there's a smudge or a stamp or a robo-signer or even a forgery of some document. As long as the judge is convinced that the right lender and the right borrower is in the room, then the judge is likely to rule in favor of the bank or whoever it is that's attempting to foreclose. Remember that if you have questions and you're okay, you've already got it. You go to the chat room, and we will answer those questions at the end of the show. Just skimming down now, my blog has the link to the case, but there are other major issues that I think ought to be highlighted, and that is the issue I raised, I guess it was 7 years ago, unconscionability, procedural unconscionability, and substantive unconscionability, which includes unfair surprise and fairness. This court found that it properly pled with the right facts, you could allege a cause of action. The importance of that, which I felt was important, I have felt was important for years, is that the statute of limitations on the Truth in Lending Act wouldn't bar you from a case involving unconscionability. The normal statute of limitations of whatever the state is would apply. On quiet title, the court concluded that you can't sue for quiet title unless you can state affirmatively that whoever you're naming as a defendant, in fact, has no interest. It can't be that they have a weakness in their claim. It has to be that they have no interest at all. And the court took up negligence per se and negligent performance of an undertaking, which went in line with a surprise, which was the Good Samaritan doctrine. And basically, the court said that a lender can be held liable when the lender or its agent or representative induces a borrower to default on his or her loan, promising a loan modification if they default, which, of course, is the case in almost all cases. And what we are now seeing is the court correctly understanding what is happening in the marketplace. Now, remember, this is an Arizona case, and it's subject to review by the Arizona Supreme Court, and it is not dispositive as to all actions in Arizona, and it is not authority in other states or federal court. It can be used as persuasive authority because in this case the court wrote a 33-page opinion, and the advantage of that is that they show their line of thinking and they show their reasoning and how they arrived at the conclusion. And for that reason, I'm recommending that the attorneys look at this case, even if they are in a judicial state, which, of course, Arizona is a non-judicial state with a deed of trust and a trustee sale. And they upheld a cause of action to avoid the trustee sale on a theory that I think would also apply in non-judicial sales as well. I encourage all the lawyers to read this decision very carefully. I think you're going to see it followed in many decisions from the Supreme Court of many states down into the appellate courts in Florida, the District Courts of Appeal, etc. With me tonight is my good friend Patrick Genta, who has an office in Broward. He is an attorney that I've been working with and in whom I hold high esteem. He is experienced. He understands the work that we are doing, and he is constantly in court. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Patrick, I thought we would take just a few moments to talk about this rocket docket thing. The problem I have with it is that these loans, 96% of them are securitized, which means if you look at any of the securitization structures, it means that it's highly complex, which in turn means to me that it's complex litigation. But the rocket docket, which is designed to move the cases quickly through the courts, treats it as though these are summary proceedings. I was wondering what thoughts you had on that.
Okay. This is what we have been observing of late, and especially in the what we call the Tri-County area, or Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County, which seem to be the counties that have had a tremendous amount of backlog cases, and a lot of cases dating back to 2009 and even before that. And the trend or the mindset of the judges has been more focused in on the way that mortgages were structured going back, way back to maybe like pre-1970, 75, 80, in those eras when you nobody really knew what a securitized mortgage meant or the process of securitization. So they're treating it as, okay, what I need to see is a note, and I need to see a mortgage and an affidavit supporting the amount due, and then I hear from the borrower that they didn't make the payment, and they're treating it as a very simplistic, which it should be, if it was a straightforward foreclosure type of case. The what we've seen recently is that they're applying that to these securitized mortgages, which are highly complex and involve some issues that you do not normally run into in the day-to-day courts. What we see a lot of is that the federal court and the bankruptcy court seem to have more of a handle on the securitization issues and some of the ways that servicers, for example, would go ahead and pay the beneficiaries under the trust, which means that the trustee beneficiaries may not even know that there was a default. So, in other words, could be that there are underlying problems that need to be addressed, but the courts, because of their rush to judgment, do not buy that theory. However, recently, it's becoming more and more prevalent, and what we're seeing now is that when a borrower challenges by getting out interrogatories, getting out requests for production of documents, filing motions that are actually supported, and you get these motions filed, then you're seeing the run-of-the-mill type of push-it-through foreclosure mill lawyers getting out of the cases, and we're getting some very good law firms that are coming in that you normally wouldn't see on a rocket docket type of case. And that's where, you know, some of your larger law firms are coming in and stepping in once they know that the borrower has a serious defense that could undermine their case. That's what I've been seeing recently, and it's starting to turn around where at least we're getting the judges by constantly going down there to start taking a look at this. And a few of them are actually entering rules or rulings in favor of the borrower.
Right, and I think, first of all, I introduced you, but I didn't give the spelling of your last name, G-I-U-N-T-A, and he works closely with us, and if you want to reach him, we're buffering the calls through the Living Lies telephone line, 954-495-9867, and if you have a question or wish to reach Patrick or me, you can call that that number. Patrick, do you think that part of the problem that we've seen with the resistance of judges to these arguments has been pro se litigants not knowing how to practice law, obviously, and some lawyers who are not honestly doing good lawyering?
Yes, the answer to both of those. What we saw going back, and a lot of this is reactionary on the part of the banks. In other words, some of the defenses that were initially brought up were good ones, and then that stopped the banks for a while, and then they found ways to in just layman's terms, ways to get around it. So you're getting appellate decisions coming out that are going back in time, and where we used to see a lot of summary judgment motions, you're seeing less summary judgment motions and more notices for trial. That's why some of the cases, the bank won't even go to summary judgment because they're not going to be able to prevail. When a pro se litigant becomes involved, while they're excellent and I think they know how to research, et cetera, they do not have the legal training or they do not have a handle on the intricacies of trial law, which is involves how do you present your facts and apply the law to those facts in order to get a favorable ruling. They do a lot of shotgun pleadings where they just write up everything, something that could be written by a lawyer in perhaps a page, page and a half, five or six paragraphs. Pro se litigants will just, you know, they'll file things that are 20, 30, 40 pages in length. And then when they go in to argue, they do not understand the rules. And, you know, they're arguing with the judge points that are really not going to do them any favors. And based on that and the number of foreclosures that came up and the people that kept coming in, I think the judges are were at least now they're coming around, but at the time they just don't believe that any of the defenses work.
It's been difficult. My observation has been that the lack of lawyering by the pro se litigants and the not so good lawyering by some other attorneys has made things difficult for the rest of us.
Absolutely.
We have some questions here, which I'm just going to take in order. We've got seven and a half minutes left on the show. Do I have any California-specific pro se foreclosure defense materials? Well, the answer is yes on the blog on the left side for the foreclosure defense forms. There are some forms that are probably California-specific, but two things. Number one, you should not be doing this pro se, as you just heard from Patrick. You should have at the very least, an attorney advising you or providing you with litigation support of some kind, and or get an attorney who, to answer the next question about referrals, I can't give referrals because every time I give referrals, it's to a lawyer that I was referring to, and now he can't take any more cases, or she can't take any more cases. They're full up. So we try to connect you as much as we can, but we're not really a referral service. The Arizona case I was just quoting from, would apply to other cases involving the FDIC, but not all mergers involved an FDIC loss-sharing agreement. So you have to make sure, you have to do your investigation, your forensic analysis, et cetera, before you make that kind of an allegation, or you're not going to be able to prove your case. You may be able to survive a motion to dismiss, like what happened in this Steinberger case, but she still has to prove her case. And so that answers that question. The question also from California, we've got calls from all over the world, actually, as well as all over the country. Is the securitization argument viable at the California Supreme Court? I think just like this case has shown, if it's pled properly and it's argued properly and it's backed up by real facts and real allegations of definite facts and not hypotheticals, then yes, I think it is potentially viable. We have seen time and time again, just as Patrick was, Jenta was just saying, where judges that were resistant are now turning and considering and listening and realizing that there is a lot to be heard in terms of the merits of the defense. If what you're talking about is the money and not just the documents. So when you have a defense that's predicated solely on defects in the documents, as opposed to the absence of documents, you're likely to meet resistance, because the judge is not going to let, judges are not going to let a person off the hook just because there's some defect in the documentation. You have to show that the money did not come from the party that is attempting to foreclose, and you have to show that the party who is attempting to foreclose is either not entitled to any of the money or not entitled to all of the money. As, for example, where third parties have made payments to the creditor, that part of the debt is discharged. So the important thing is that you must consult with an attorney if you're a pro se caller, and for the attorneys, you've got to do the work. Now, this is my ending comment for tonight. The problem with lawyers being able to do the work, and the reason why they haven't been doing all the work necessary, is that they haven't been getting paid enough to do it. And the necessary forensic analysts have not been hired. The experts have not been consulted. So the lawyer has nothing really to say. So the moral of the story is that if you really want a decent result, you're going to need to make a full commitment to saving the home. If and the attorney, you know, some people just want to kick the can down the road and, you know, stay in the house for as long as they can without paying anything. And, okay, if that's your goal, you know that you're going to be kicked out eventually. But I think in most of these cases, it's probably possible to present a credible threat to them so that you do get a modification. And under recent decisions against Wells Fargo and this decision here in Arizona, it is possible to force the modification, the settlement of the case, and those people who have the money and who are offering to pay the loan off if the opposing side can prove ownership and the balance of the note are finding that they're getting some pretty good settlements. All of those are confidential, of course. So, okay, I guess I've decided that 30 minutes may not be enough for this show. I'll answer the questions regarding Glaske and the other questions in another way. In the meanwhile, I thank you all for joining me. Thank you, Patrick, for being
the first guest.
And I'll see you next week, same time, same place, every Thursday, 6 p.m., the Neil Garfield Show. Thank you for joining me.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to the Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lies Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies, analysis, expert consultations, testimony, and declarations to use in your battle against the largest economic crime in human history. For information concerning Neil, the team at Living Lies, or the law firm, go to www.livinglives.wordpress.com or call 520-405-1688. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and should not be attributed to any other person or entity.